Well, we're always glad to come to Shawnee for a number of reasons, and are happy to be back again for this course in church history. I want to make some introductory remarks to begin with, just about how the courses, at least how I plan to lay it out. So this is always flexible depending on how things go, but to cover the chapters that were assigned, and I eliminated two or three just to shorten it a bit, we need to do an average of three a night plus one. So tonight I hope to cover four chapters. The first two chapters are fairly familiar material to us, I think, because they have to do with the time of the New Testament and what led up to that. And I'm going to be following the textbook pretty closely, and I hope for those of you who have it and have read it, that doesn't mean meaningless repetition. There's an awful lot to digest, and even if you've read it, I think you've not digested it all. So hopefully it'll be helpful to us to go over it again, selectively, and not cover everything that's in the textbook. And, of course, I'll be adding to that my own perspective on things out of a more general knowledge. I'll try to give an opportunity for questions or comments as we go along, and I welcome that. I think interaction is always helpful. Some of you are wanting to do, I understand, an exam and a paper, and I'll plan to have a separate time to meet with folks who are going to do that. We won't take up the general time in talking about how to go about that. You were handed out, I think, some selected or suggested topics for a term paper. That's not meant to be, it doesn't mean that those are the only possible topics, but to give you an idea of what would be appropriate, and I'll be glad to talk with you about what might be of interest to you. And for the exam, before, probably at the end of our time, I'll be handing out a review sheet that would help you to kind of focus your preparation for taking an exam. Well, Wade has commented on the title of this series. There are to be four parts of this work by Needham. Needham, by the way, was a Baptist, Calvinistic Baptist, who taught in a seminary in the north of Scotland, and before that in a missionary seminary in Nigeria. And one of the reasons I think that he is careful to explain things like the opening section on how time is calculated. He's working in Nigeria with students that didn't have a lot of background, and so he was especially conscious of that, and I think that's helpful to the rest of this of us as well. I was really intrigued by the title when I saw it. I think that he doesn't emphasize Christ's rule as he actually lays out the history. It's in the background of his thought, but it's not on the surface of the way he writes about history, but it's a good and biblical perspective. In addition to what Wade read, I wanted to call your attention to a passage I came across this morning in my devotions, Daniel chapter 2. You probably know this passage. It's the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar, and remember the he kind of set a trap for his wise men. He said, "You tell me the dream, and then you tell me what it means." And they weren't prepared for that. They could make up what it meant if he would tell them what the dream was. But he was going to see if they had really good information. And then you remember Daniel came to him and tried to prevent the slaughter of these wise men and went and prayed with his companions, and then God gave the answer, gave both the dream and its answer. And I wanted to read just a few verses, Daniel 2, verse 31. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. And this great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And you watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image in its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. And then to go down to Daniel's explanation, verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand. He's made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others. And then to go down a little later, verse 44, in the days of these kings, that is after this fourth kingdom has been broken up into parts, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. The kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And the four parts of the image represent the kingdoms of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and then the Medo-Persians, and then the Greeks, Alexander the Great, and then Rome. And in the days of the Roman Empire is when Christ ascends into heaven, and in a dramatic expansion takes authority, and then proceeds to build his kingdom and to bring about the end of the Roman Empire eventually. And Needham has a quote at the beginning of the book from Jonathan Edwards. And this is from Edwards' History of the Work of Redemption. And this is what Edwards wrote. Though the learning and power of the Roman Empire were so great, and both were employed to the utmost against Christianity, yet all was in vain. They could neither root it out nor stop its progress. In spite of all, the kingdom of Christ wonderfully prevailed, and Satan's heathen kingdom moldered and consumed away before it. Agreeable to the text, the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. And so that's what happened in the time of the Roman Empire, and that continues to go on. I remember a speaker. I've often referred to this. I may have done it here on another occasion. We had a speaker years ago at seminary from Romania. His name was Joseph Son, and he had been under the ministry of Martin Lloyd-Jones in London when he was really in exile there from communist Romania. And the Iron Curtain had just fallen when he came to speak at the seminary, and he said, I hear Christian people say all the time, well, I wonder what Satan is going to do next to prevent the gospel from going forward. And Joseph Son said, that's the wrong question. The question is, what is Jesus Christ going to do next? And so then has come a significant opening of the countries behind the Iron Curtain to the gospel in ways that 30 years ago most of us couldn't have imagined. And so that's the perspective here. Christ is building his church and extending his kingdom. But a couple of more general comments. If you've read the book or if you read church history, it can often be quite discouraging. Now, what we've just been talking about is an optimistic view of history, and that's a biblical view, and we need to hold on to that. When we think of facing militant Islam today, and sometimes it seems to be insuperable, and we can get discouraged and fearful. So we need to be optimistic, but we need to realize that Christ builds his kingdom using very imperfect people. And so we're not studying about some ideal age in which everything was right and everything in the church was right. It's always a mixture. Christ is working with people who are imperfectly sanctified. And I think we need to be realistic about that, but also be encouraged to know from the scripture and from history that in spite of the foibles and the sins and the imperfections of the people, Christ is still working through folks like us to build his kingdom. So we have our own foibles and sins and failures, but Christ will still use us for his glory and for building his kingdom. So those are some preliminary remarks. Oh, one other I wanted to mention to you. Where does Needham get all of this information? Well, he gets it from other historians who have gone back to written materials that have come down from the time period that we're talking about. But involved in that is something of a distortion, because especially in the days before literacy was more common, was less common than it is now, only the rich and the powerful left behind them a written record of their lives. And so when you study the ancient history, you have to work with written materials, and they talk about a certain segment of society. And so it's hard to get an accurate picture of what the faith and the life of ordinary Christians was. And I think part of the description of evil is connected to that, because as someone said, Edmund Burke, I think, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're talking about people who are especially subject to that kind of temptation. And I think that God's work is often done through quiet, unknown people that don't leave maybe much of a record behind, but they have a record in heaven. So what we're reading is not the whole story of what was going on in the church. Well, with that, we come to chapter 1 in the book, which has to do with historical background, both in terms of the Roman Empire, which is the political framework within which Christ came and the church got its start, and then also a description of what was involved in the Jewish people in the first century as the church had its beginning. Well, the Roman Empire was in those days very extensive, reaching in the east, in the west as far as Britain. Rome, you know, you can go to, I've not seen it myself, but I've read about it. You can go to England and you can find there Hadrian's Wall that was built across the north of England, which was done by the Romans. So they, in days when travel was not very easy, they went a long way. And also, in something that is hard for us to imagine now, North Africa was a part of the Roman Empire. And indeed, later became a stronghold of Christianity. Augustine, of course, was from North Africa. The three most prominent cities of the Roman Empire were Rome, no surprise, but Alexandria in Egypt, and Carthage in northwest Africa, probably Morocco. I didn't check that, but northwest Africa, third largest and most influential city in the Roman Empire. And that extensive empire had come about through military conquest. Julius Caesar, remember, was involved in wars in France. All Gaul is divided into three parts. Did you, if you had Latin, you had to learn to translate that. I came, I saw, I conquered. And so by its military power, Rome had come to control a vast empire. Rome, with the city of Rome, was founded about the time of the prophet Isaiah, when you think about that. 8th century B.C., and then about 510 B.C., there was a republic formed, not probably like a modern republic, but with the rule in the hands of a senate that was made up of kind of the aristocracy of Rome. And that Senate ruled then for a long time, but then there were civil wars and a lot of turmoil. Julius Caesar was assassinated, and then his nephew, Octavius, became the ruler, and he came to dominate. So instead of the Senate ruling, you had a single ruler, Caesar Augustus. And he was a very successful, very powerful emperor, and he established a pattern of one-man rule that lasted for a long time in the Roman Empire. He's mentioned, you remember, in the Gospel of Luke, in the days of Caesar Augustus, there was an order for the census that took Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem. Because of this, of the rule of Rome over this vast territory, they could have economic activity that was over that vast area. So the empire was held together by a common economy. The culture, however, thinking of things like language and philosophy and education and arts and literature, the culture was not Roman, but Greek. And then went back to the time of Alexander the Great, who had also conquered a vast territory. And so it is that our New Testament was written not in Aramaic, which was the language that Jesus and the disciples would have spoken, but written in Greek. And this was part of a providential preparation for the spread of the gospel, that in those days there was not a significant language barrier to the spread of the gospel in this vast area. In the eastern part of the empire, Greek was the first language of the people. And in the western part of the empire, Latin was the first language, but many of the people would also have known Greek as a second language. And so the preaching of the gospel was in Greek, and the New Testament was written in Greek. That's the culture then of the Roman Empire. Word about the religions in the Roman Empire, not one, but several religions. And one of the things that is true of all of the period that we're talking about, up through the time of the Reformation, and it's hard to know when this comes to an end. It was a gradual thing. But there was no thought of religion being a separate part of life. Dr. Voss of Geneva, I remember, used to talk about this. He said, these days we think about our worldview is like that of Time magazine, in which you have politics and economics and entertainment and religion. Religion is a separate section from the others. Well, that's a modern way to look at the world. And it's not even pervasive over the whole world today. I think one of the things that strikes Americans as strange, hard to get a hold of in Islamic fundamentalism, is that it's all of life, every aspect of life, governed by Islam and by Sharia law and the principles of the Quran and so on. For modern Europeans and Americans, we tend more to think about religion as a separate category, and for many people doesn't deeply and consciously touch the whole of their life. But it was not true then. And so in the traditional pagan religion, they had for all the different areas of life different gods. And you can speculate about that. Augustine does in his great work called The City of God, and he kind of laughs at the names of all of the Roman gods. And he would say, I think it's right, sort of dreamed up to cover all of the different aspects of life. But the point was, they did cover all the aspects of life. And there were religious exercises of prayer and the sacrifice and the practice of divination, trying to foretell ways to foretell the future. And the leaders of the civil government had priestly functions. They were the emperor was, in a sense, the chief priest of the Roman nation. So the great literature that comes from that time, things that I confess I know about only because I come across it in crossword puzzles, where you have to know the names of these things, but the Iliad and the Odyssey, great classical works like that, have all of this pagan religion and the pagan gods interwoven in it. And out of that background, there came to develop emperor worship. Augustus was so powerful and so successful that he came to be revered as a god. And then that tended to happen also with the other Roman emperors. So that a test that was often proposed to the Christians in time of persecution was whether or not they would be willing to burn incense to the gods, to the emperor, I'm sorry, to burn incense to the emperor. And was Christ Lord or was Caesar Lord? And part of the story of this period is many people, men and women, who were unwilling to say Caesar is Lord, and gave their lives rather than give up their profession of faith in Christ. In thinking about this kind of religion, haven't had a chance to talk to Gene and Ruth about this, but I'm wondering if there isn't a parallel with Shinto nationalism, in which it's hard to separate out loyalty to the government and to the nation and to the emperor and religion. And so I remember a vivid picture, I think, in World Magazine. Very striking, because it was a Japanese classroom in school, and they were all bowing down to the Japanese flag, except for one student who was blonde. A missionary child, I think, in the class. So just the contrast between the black-headed Japanese kids and the blonde student, and they all deeply bowing, and the blonde kid upright. And is that like saying the Pledge of Allegiance, or is that an act of worship? You know, that would be the kind of question. Also in this time, in a fairly recent development, there were a number of Eastern mystery cults. And there were various goddesses, often they were female, but not always, who were at the center of these, Cybele, Isis, Serapis, and especially Mithras, who was a special favorite among the Roman soldiers. These religions involved something quite experiential. They had they gathered together for special sacred rites that were often very emotional, very dramatic. Needham gives you, if you've read it, maybe in more detail than you would like, the initiation ceremony in Mithraism, in which the one who was to be, in a sense, baptized into the cult was placed down in a pit under a grate, and above him a bull was slaughtered, and the blood flowed down over the person who was being initiated into the cult. Very experiential, very dramatic, and they had the kind of music that would stir people up and so on. The typical religion was not, did not involve people experientially in that way. It was a kind of way to kind of cover your bases, look for good luck or good fortune, but not something deeply experiential. The mystery religions were more experiential. And you had to make a conscious decision to become a part of one of the mystery cults. And so people have talked about whether Christianity was sort of a development out of that. At least they've talked about parallels between the mystery religions and Christianity. And unlike the general worship, the mystery cults did talk about attaining life after death by participation in the cult. Needham has a section on the philosophy of the time, and I at least don't go very far in philosophy before my eyes tend to glaze over, so I'm not going to deal with this in detail. But let me mention, he mentions three kinds in particular, and I think they have some relevance to things that we see today, so I will mention them. The first is Platonism, from the Greek philosopher Plato, who was lived back in the 5th and the 4th century BC. Plato talked about God, in the singular. Many Christians were attracted later to Platonism, though I think the differences are much greater than the similarities. The two things that I want to mention about Platonism, and this was true in general of Greek thought, that it operated with a strong sense of dualism. And by that, we mean that there's a sharp distinction between spirit and matter. Also, eternity and time. And also the idea that this realm is good and this realm is evil. So this is what we call Greek dualism. This is a very simplistic way of talking about it, but I think it helps us to think about it. You may know that Socrates, who was the mentor of Plato, was actually sentenced to death by the rulers in Athens for corrupting the morals and the religion, especially of the youth. And there's a story about the death of Socrates, I think, that illustrates this. A man by the name of Joachim Jeremias has written about this, contrasting the death of Socrates and the death of Christ. And the death of Christ is an agonizing death. Jeremias is looking at it from that kind of perspective. Jesus shrinks back from his death in the Garden of Gethsemane. "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me." Well, in contrast to that, much earlier, Socrates sentenced to death, and the mode of death was he was allowed himself to take poison and to end his life. And so he gathers with his disciples, and it's a rather peaceful kind of a scene. He drinks the poison. And when he waits for it to take effect, he discourses, he talks with his disciples about the immortality of the soul. So he dies talking philosophy. And the point of the contrast that Jeremias makes is that Jesus, no surprise, has a Hebrew and biblical understanding of human nature and of death. And death means a tearing apart of human nature because we were created, body and soul, to be a unity. And death, in a terrible way, disrupts that unity. But for a Greek view, Greek dualism, this is why I'm talking about this. In the view of Socrates and of Plato, all of our misery, all of our evil comes about because our pure souls are imprisoned in material bodies. And matter, by its very nature, not mater, I never can spell on the board, especially when I'm talking. I didn't mean to say my mother was evil in that way. By its very nature, matter is evil. And so we are trapped in material bodies. And so to be released from the body is really to achieve salvation. And there's another aspect that's involved in that, and it is that in Platonism, there is no sharp distinction between God as spirit and the human spirit. We could say the creator creature distinction does not apply there. Spirits are, by their very nature, good. And so to be delivered from the body is to be united with God. And in fact, to become God or become a part of God, something like that. So there isn't the sense of the sharp distinction between God as creator and created spirits. And that has all sorts of ramifications. It results in things like we see later in Augustine. We'll talk about him down the road, but in his earlier life, he was a Neoplatonist. And when he was converted, as you may know, he was living with a mistress and had a son by her. And when he became a Christian, he didn't say, well, if I want to be obedient to God, I need to marry my mistress and be committed to her in that way. He put her away, kept his son, but put away his mistress, and had a view that whereas marriage was permissible for Christians, it was not the best kind of life because it involved the body and pleasure, bodily pleasure and so on. And so there's been a strand ever since in the Roman Catholic Church of marriage being making you a kind of second-class person. Can still be saved, but not as spiritual as to be single, and hence priestly celibacy as the pattern, sort of the ideal pattern in the Roman Catholic Church. That's an expression of dualism. Well, then just a word about Epicureanism. Epicureanism we associate with a common phrase that many people use, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's quoted in the Bible as a wrong view, but it is the view of Epicureanism. Epicurus himself didn't have in mind when he said eat, drink, and be merry, really living it up. His idea was that we ought to aim in life, and this is really the purpose of life, we ought to aim in life for that which will give the greatest long-term pleasure. And he thought that that was to be found in mental delight rather than in physical delight. I don't know, it's in our culture, but I don't know if you've ever read it. There is a movie about it. James Hilton's Lost Horizons. Do you know that story? It's where we get Shangri-La from. He's a traveler, the main character in the story is a traveler that ends up in a monastery somewhere in the Himalayas, and there the people give themselves to great music and poetry and intellectual discourse. And in the story, as long as you stay there in that atmosphere, you will not die. You live forever. But the picture of the pleasure of that place, not sensual pleasure, but intellectual and artistic pleasure, is really an expression of what Epicurus was advocating, but did not have a view. This is different from what Hilton put in his story. Did not have a view of life after death. And then Stoicism. Needham also mentioned he believed the Stoic philosophers believed in a materialistic universe. Controlled by a force that could be named God or fate or even reason. And the idea in Stoicism was that you had to bridle your emotions, you had to bridle your passions and live according to reason and to accept your fate without fighting against it. sort of, this isn't quite just, but go with the flow. Don't fight against things passionately, but try to fit in, try to be in harmony with the material universe. And so that's in the philosophical background of the New Testament. You may remember that when Paul spoke to the philosophers in Athens, it's recorded in Acts chapter 17, we're told by Luke that there were Stoics and Epicureans there. And in fact, in his remarks to them, Paul quotes from two Greek writers, one of whom was a Stoic and one of whom was an Epicurean. So all of this is in the background of what we read in the New Testament, and it was the atmosphere in which the early church had its life, and it was against these ideas and these patterns of life that they had to contend. Well, that's the background of the sort of the cultural and political situation in which the church began. And I don't mean began absolutely. I believe the church was in the Old Testament, but the church in its New Testament form. And then the Jewish background. We know about the background of the Jewish people from the Old Testament. But after they came back from the Babylonian captivity, they had a very difficult time, never achieved the kind of prominence and prosperity that they had under David and Solomon. And they got involved with Rome in the first century B.C. When there was a Jewish civil war, and Rome came in and took advantage of that opportunity to side with one of the leaders, with the leader on one side, a man by the name of Hyrcanus. He was from the family of the Maccabees. You know, the Catholics have in their Bible two books of the Apocrypha called First and Second Maccabees. Well, these are descendants of those folks. And so Rome got involved, and always after that, Rome was really dominant in Palestine and over the Jewish people. They allowed there to be a local government, but they were ultimately in control. So it's a similar thing, and this is even for some of you getting to be too far back in history, but the way in which the Eastern European nations were under the Soviet Union, in which there were local governments and local laws and so forth, but always representatives of Soviet Union there to control things and to see that things were done, with the threat always of Soviet armies to come in and to enforce what the will of the USSR was. And that was something of the situation in among the Jewish people. They had a king, Herod, who had been put in place by the Roman government, and then there was also at the time of the crucifixion, of course, the governor Pilate, who was Roman and spoke directly for the Roman government there, maintained Roman rule there. I read recently the novel Ben-Hur. I've seen the movie more than once. Maybe you have too. It's really interesting to go back and read the book itself, and I'm still trying to kind of analyze its view of Christ. That's a really, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Tale of the Christ, and so it's not just about Ben-Hur, but it talks all about this setting, and talks about the Ben-Hur is characterized by his intense hatred of the Roman government and Roman rule. And so Messala, who's the other guy in the chariot race, he represents Rome. And Ben-Hur, the Jew, he comes to be kind of the focus of his hatred of Rome. So it's, you might, some, I found it quite interesting to go back and read it again. And I think it will lead you to reflect. I don't endorse fully Wallace's view of Christ and of Christianity that's there, but it really kind of makes the setting come alive in the days in which we are talking about. Well, as you know, there were divisions among the Jewish people, and Needham mentions four of them. We're most familiar with the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and between those two, we are more familiar with the Pharisees, and I'll mention the reason for that in a little bit. We're not told a lot about the Sadducees, except in Matthew 22 and Acts 23, we are told they didn't believe in the resurrection. The resurrection of the dead. We're not talking about Christ's resurrection only, but in general, will there be a resurrection of the dead in the life to come? Pharisees affirmed that. Sadducees denied it. Sadducees were, in some respects, to draw a parallel, like the modernists of our present day, not inclined to believe in the supernatural, except maybe in a kind of deistic way, that God is way off someplace and not actively involved in the world that he's created. And we're told, it's in Acts 23, I believe, that they don't believe in angels or spirits. So they're kind of naturalists, in this, not in the sense that they study nature, but they believed that nature is all there is, and rejected the supernatural. And they were also very political. They were had been placed in power by the Roman rulers and collaborated with them because of the power and the prestige that they enjoyed. The Pharisees, a much larger group than the Sadducees, were in one sense very religious. And in their early days, they had begun as real, having real zeal for obedience to the law of God. I think by the time of Jesus and the New Testament, that had deteriorated a great deal. But they advocated repentance and return to the Mosaic law. And in contrast to the Sadducees, they believed in angels and spirits and the resurrection. And Needham makes a comment that I put a question mark against. He says the Sadducees accepted only the Pentateuch out of the Old Testament, not the whole Old Testament. And by contrast, then, the Pharisees accepted all of the Old Testament. I read in a Bible dictionary about the Sadducees that some of the early Christian writers said that about the Sadducees, but probably by getting them confused with the Samaritans. It is pretty clear that the Samaritans accepted only the first five books of the Bible. It was called the Samaritan Pentateuch. It's a small point, doesn't make a lot of difference, but I don't think it's clear that that distinguished the Pharisees from the Sadducees, that Pharisees accepted the whole Old Testament and the Sadducees didn't. Of course, this is particularly true of the Pharisees. They'd also added to the Old Testament what are called the traditions of the elders. An enormous body of material. We have today, there are two different editions, what's called the Talmud, which is a collection of Jewish writings. And I don't know if you've ever seen a page of the Talmud. It's very interesting. They'll have a In a square in the middle of the page, they have a part of the Hebrew text. And then surrounding that are what some of the rabbis said about the Hebrew text. And then surrounding that are reflections on what the rabbis said. So that when Jewish people study the Talmud, they're kind of two steps removed from what was actually in the Old Testament. We used to see in the summertime around White Lake Camp in New York, which is in the area where these days a lot of Hasidic Jews go for the summer. And in hot August weather, you'd see guys in long black coats and black hats on, sitting at a table out in the grass in front of the cabin, with Talmud open before them on the table and bowing back and forth as they read Talmud. But they're not really, they're not studying the Old Testament itself for itself. They're studying the traditions of the elders. And that comes out of Phariseeism, that approach to the Word of God. Well, there were zealots who were freedom fighters opposed to Roman rule and the payment of taxes. By the way, Wallace has Ben-Hur as a zealot, at least with the same kind of standpoint or perspective as they had. And one of Jesus' disciples, you remember, was Simon the Zealot. They were the revolutionaries. And then there was a group, and we don't know about these from the New Testament, but a group called the Essenes, who lived at least a prominent community, lived near the Dead Sea Scroll. We know of them today through the Dead Sea Scrolls, the so-called Qumran community. They were a communal group. Quite critical of the religious hierarchy in Jerusalem. And they were apocalyptic. They were looking for the coming of the Messiah and things being made right fairly soon. In addition to these groups, there were which were found in Palestine, in the Holy Land, there were many Jews who were living in other places. Needham estimates 6 million Jews scattered throughout the Roman Empire, perhaps 1 million of them in the city of Alexandria in Egypt. And then, at the time of the great festivals in Jerusalem, these dispersed Jews, many of them, would travel to Jerusalem for the Passover and the other festivals. So on the day of Pentecost in the book of Acts, remember, it talks about, I think, 14 different people groups, nationalities represented there on the day of Pentecost. And the miracle of tongues had to do with their communication with all of those diverse groups. Interesting that God did a miracle there, didn't have Peter speak in Greek, this common language, but they had heard in their own languages the wonderful works of God. And then connected to the Jews were the proselytes, or the God-fearers, Gentiles who had not accepted circumcision but were deeply attracted to Judaism and participating as they were able in the worship of the synagogue. And you think of Cornelius in Acts chapter 10, the Roman centurion, who the people said about him, he loves our people and he's built us a synagogue. So adherents, we would call them in modern language, to the Jewish religion. And at the time of the New Testament, the relationships between Jews and Rome were getting worse. And of course, by 70 AD, you have the destruction, the capture of Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple by the Roman army. Well, let me pause for a minute and give you opportunity to ask questions or make comments about what we've done. This is chapter 1. Well, let's talk about what Needham calls the Jesus Movement. Is his title for the second chapter, and he's talking about the beginning of the church. And he makes the point that at the beginning, the church is nearly is almost entirely Jewish. The crowd on the day of Pentecost, well, all of Jesus' disciples, of course, were Jewish. His ministry is confined to the land of Palestine, except for maybe one venture up into the northwest. And he does interact with some individuals who are Gentiles, but he said, "I'm sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." So his disciples are Jewish. On the day of Pentecost, it is a Jewish crowd almost entirely that is gathered there when 3,000 men are converted and baptized. And really, the story of the book of Acts is to move from Jerusalem and Jews to Rome, the capital of the Roman Empire, and to a church that was predominantly Jewish, predominantly Gentile. That's the movement of the book of Acts. And we often cite Acts 1:8, "You will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be witnesses to me in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost part of the earth." And what preachers are inclined to do with that verse is to say, well, you will be witnesses unto me in Kansas City and in Kansas and in the United States and to the uttermost part of the earth. But it's not in the book of Acts. I don't dismiss that. I mean, we ought to think in terms of the gospel for folks near at hand and the gospel for people further away. But in the book of Acts, it is kinds of people that are being reached by the gospel. So to move to the Samaritans is to move to people who are not pure Jews, either ethnically or religiously, but kind of a mixture. And you remember in the Gospels, the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans, chapter 4 of John. And so the gospel, which is for all people, for the whole world, not just for the Jews, goes out from a Jewish beginning and a Jewish base to Samaria in the early part of the book of Acts. Then Cornelius comes in, who is a Gentile. And then Paul's missionary journeys going out to the whole world. And so there's the breaking down of the Jewish separation and exclusiveness. And a lot of the drama of the New Testament was in the early church coming to grips with that. And Jewish people who had a long history of oppression and persecution by the Romans being willing finally to sit down at the same communion table with those who had at least had been a part of the group that had earlier oppressed them. And so that's the movement that is happening in the New Testament. You could think about Israelis and Palestinians today coming together in the same church to have a sense about what the difficulty would be of that coming about. I remember when I was in Romania, we were among Hungarian Reformed people. The northwestern part of Romania is Transylvania. We didn't see Dracula, by the way, but Romania, quite it's a beautiful area in the mountains. But the Hungarian, ethnic Hungarian people who live in Romania are virtually all members of the Hungarian Reformed Church. It's the culture religion. And whether people have personal faith or not, they're a part of this ethnic church. And we were with some folks in that church who were evangelicals, and among them there were people who wanted to reach out to the gypsies, a large gypsy population, in fact, whole towns in Romania of gypsies. And so there was a pastor who had gone to gypsy folks with the gospel and brought them into church, and we're told a story about one congregation where a gypsy appeared, and the organist in the church stood up and shouted, "Either they go or I go. Not going to have gypsies in our church." And so these kinds of barriers still exist. We need to be aware of that. But they were very real in that day. A congregation that we spent the most time in had 10,000 members. 9,999 were Hungarian. There was one Romanian. And she had married a Hungarian. So... But that was a real barrier in the time in which we're talking about. And, you know, the Apostle Paul had to write a lot about this. In Christ, there's neither Jew nor Gentile. And so it was a significant movement that was taking place in this time. Needham says, Paul was the man who made it possible for the Jesus movement to turn from being a purely Jewish sect into a largely Gentile body. And then he says, you may want to think about this, ponder it. Next to Jesus himself, Paul has had the greatest historical impact on the life and thought of the Christian church over the past 2,000 years. Well, think about the Reformation coming about because Luther studied Paul. And that's worth thinking about. The way God used, this is the way we ought to say it, the way God used a man like Paul, who was a Hellenist in the sense that he had been raised in Tarsus, which was a Roman colony, but trained in Jerusalem. So he was the man God chose to bridge that gap. Then, in this period, the first official persecution of the church by the Romans comes. It's not the first persecution. We read about persecutions in the New Testament, in the book of Acts, particularly Paul, often imprisoned and beaten and driven out of towns and so forth for preaching the gospel. But this is from the top under Nero in 64 AD. The city of Rome, much of it had been burned with fire. In a great fire, Nero was suspected of having set the fire because he wanted to build the city in a more glorious way for his own honor. But to deflect the suspicion that was lodged against him, he blamed the Christians and began to persecute them. And I wanted to read for you on page 50 in the text something that the Roman historian Tacitus wrote about this. To kill the rumors that he had started the fire, Nero charged and tortured some people hated for their evil practices. You could put evil practices in quotation marks. The group popularly known as Christians. The founder of this sect, Christ, had been put to death by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, when Tiberius was emperor. Their deadly superstition had been suppressed temporarily, but was beginning to spring up again. not now just in Judea, but even in Rome itself, where all kinds of sordid and shameful activities are attracted and catch on. And, you know, they would, for example, accuse the Christians of cannibalism, because in the Lord's Supper they would talk about eating Christ's flesh and drinking his blood. Or because they called one another brother and sister, they would accuse them of immoral sexual relationships within the fellowship. That's what he means when he talks about sordid and shameful activities. First, the authorities arrested those who confessed to being Christians. Then, on information obtained from them, the courts convicted hundreds more, not so much for starting the fire as for their antisocial beliefs. In their deaths, they were made a mockery. They were covered in the skins of wild animals, torn to death by dogs, crucified, or set on fire, so that when darkness fell, they burned like torches in the night. Nero opened his own gardens for this spectacle and gave a show in the arena, where he mixed with the crowd or stood dressed as a charioteer on a chariot. As a result, although they were guilty of being Christians and deserved to die, people began to feel sorry for them, for they realized that they were being killed not for the public good, but to satisfy one man's madness. Now, that's a horrific kind of description, and it touches us as we read about this. Not to mitigate that at all, but you need to realize that the persecution under Nero was local. That is, it was only in Rome. It was not throughout the whole empire. Later persecutions were. And it was relatively over a short period of time. Perhaps 1 year, perhaps 3 years, but probably not more than that. Very severe for the people, for the Christians who were living in Rome. And then there was, 30 years later, another general persecution under the Emperor Domitian in 96 AD, and that was the time when the Apostle John was sent in exile to the island of Patmos. I mentioned about the growing trouble between the Romans and the Jews, and there were uprisings against Roman rule beginning in 66 AD, and Rome came down hard on that, sent an army under Titus that captured Jerusalem and destroyed it in 70 AD. And Josephus, it's hard to know about these numbers, but Josephus, who was a Jewish historian who lived at that time, and actually a friend of Rome and of the emperor, he estimated that 1 million Jews were killed in that destruction of Jerusalem. The Jews who were Christians had fled the city ahead of time, being warned by what was in Jesus' teaching in Matthew 24, for example. And so they escaped the destruction. But many of the Jewish people perished in that time. And here are three effects that Needham gives of that destruction: that Judaism and Christianity lost their spiritual home. The center of the life of the Christian church now moves away from Jerusalem, first to Antioch and then more and more west until Rome becomes the center. And Judaism, Jewish people for many years, did not have a, of course they did not after that have a temple, And many of them, perhaps the majority, lived away from Palestine and Jerusalem. The gap, secondly, the gap widened between Jews and Jewish Christians because of the fact that the Jewish Christians had not joined in the revolt. And so you can understand Jews being offended by that. And thirdly, the Pharisees became the leading force in Judaism. And I mentioned the Talmud. That was a Jewish, basically a collection of Pharisees' traditions and teachings. And they came to identify and characterize Judaism after that time. So that's chapter 2, and it's time for us to take a break.